There's a little black spot on the sun today. It's the same old thing as yesterday. There's a black hat caught in a high tree top. There's a flagpole rack and the wind won't stop. Stood here before inside the pouring rain, with the world turning circles running round my brain. I guess I'm always hoping that you'll end this way, but it's my destiny to be the king of pain. There's a little black spot on the sun today. It's the same old thing as yesterday.
Hey y'all, welcome back to another episode of Put It In Your Pocket, your source for all niche music trivia. My name's Caroline, and today we have a new intro. I wanted to try out something new and just play a quick song before we got started, and I think I like this format, so we'll see how that continues into the future. But if you haven't figured it out by now, we're talking about The Police this week, which I'm super excited to do. Shout out to my mom for giving me the idea. We were walking around in Walmart and we were talking about different stuff about music, because when am I not talking about that? And she was like, you know what I've always wondered is, you know, these certain songs that The Police puts out, like, one, what is he saying? Two, why is he saying it? Because I think that The Police are an interesting group because they're very weird and very different, but they're also so mainstream at the same time. It's funny because in my mind, they're like kind of a reggae group. They're off the wall. Sting is super domineering, and like I think about him immediately, like I'm sure a lot of people do, but I also think about like all the stories that came out of Synchronicity and all the tension in the band. And to me, they're just not like a super group, but they are one of the most successful bands of all time. They have some of the most successful radio hits of all time, as we'll learn and discover in this episode. So I think that there is a bit of a disconnect between people who know a lot about The Police and people who hear them on the radio, and we're going to rectify that today, because by God, are we going to go to school? Hopefully not, like in Don't Stand So Close to Me, but we are going to go to school and learn some things about The Police today, which I'm super excited to do. So that song that you just heard, you've probably heard before. It's called King of Pain, and it was released as the second single from The Police's fifth and final studio album, Synchronicity, which came out in 1983. We'll talk about Synchronicity a lot in this episode because it's one of the greatest albums of all time. It's definitely their best album, Come and Fight Me, and I was going to do this episode just on that album, but I really wanted to include one song that we're going to play next. And that is not off of Synchronicity. So I figured we would just do a Police little roundtable thing today. But obviously King of Pain was written by Sting, as a lot of stuff on Synchronicity was. And it was a post-divorce song from his wife. It reached number 3rd on the US Billboard Hot 100 in October 1983, number 1 on the Billboard Top Tracks chart for 5 weeks, and in the UK it reached number 17, making it the band's last UK top 20 hit. Alanis Morissette covered it in her MTV Unplugged album in 1999, and it was released as the second single from that album. I'm interested to see how many people remember that, and like what version was more popular, because that was kind of a minor hit for her, and she has a really good cover of it as well. I like her acoustic Unplugged stuff a lot more than I like her actual, like, heavily produced music that you like hear on the radio. So that's just like a me thing. That's not like it's bad or anything. But I really do like her version of it. So definitely check that out if you're interested. But I just wanted to sneak that song in there because it is a great introduction to kind of how we're going to discuss The Police today. I'm not going to go into their history because it's long and complicated like any band of that status is. And we're not going to go into Sting because that is a whole nother 8 episodes, but I kind of wanted to give a brief overview and maybe some insight into some hits and one little deep cut, and kind of shed some light on maybe some unsung parts of their story throughout the latter years of their career. And I just wanted to play King of Pain because I think it is very like thematically on point, because King of Pain is so dramatic. Oh my gosh. Sting is one of those rock stars that is like very teenage girl. Kurt Cobain is that way to me. Bruce Springsteen is that way to me, not in like a immature way. Bruce Springsteen is like deeply understanding of the female psyche. I'm not going to go into explanation of that. That will be another four-parter, I'm sure. But there are certain male rock stars that I feel like deeply understand like that experience. And King of Pain is so like waking up on a random Tuesday and, you know, you forgot your like Starbucks gift card in the morning and you're walking out to your car and you're like, man, my life is horrible. Everything sucks. God is out to get me. What is the point of anything? That little dark spot on the sun, that's my soul up there. Like who writes stuff like that as nonchalantly as Sting does? He's so good at it. But I think obviously he was going through his divorce, but I just think the way that he sings and writes about these things are so funny because they come across like so immature, but in such a mature way because the music is so great. And I think King of Pain is like his magnum opus when it comes to stuff like that. And when we get earlier into their career, this next song we're going to talk about was released in 1980. So about 3 years before King of Pain would have came out with Synchronicity. When we get into their earlier stuff, they're still experimenting with like their reggae sound, which is kind of dropped on Synchronicity for the most part. And it's like fully explored in the midpoint of their career. But in the early 80s, I feel like they really were kind of shying away from that like just full force, like full Sting personality songwriting, and they were maybe being a little bit more like generic with what they were saying. And the perfect example of that in an ironic and just fully genuine way is Da Do Da Do Da 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 Da, which came out in 1980, releases a single in the US and a second single in the UK from their albums in Yada Mandata. And this song has always been one of my favorites of theirs just because it's catchy. I have no other reason. I think it sounds great. It's so much fun. And the drums that we're getting on this are so good. But this song is also very interesting. This is the song that spurred the conversation between me and my mom, where she was like, what does that song mean? Like, genuinely, what does that mean? And I was like, you know what? I'm going to answer that question for you in the podcast, because I think that's a super fun song to break down. And the cool thing about this song is that it's one of those, like, it has meaning and also it doesn't. And I love that discussion. Y'all know this by now, that I love the are they being genuine, are they playing with us argument when it comes to lyrics, especially with bands like The Police. We talked about that, like, conversation a lot. Nirvana's episode, because Kurt Cobain does that a lot, is very on the nose in that way. And according to Sting, this song is about the attraction that people have to, like, simpler nonsense songs. He later said that those who labeled the lyrics as, like, baby talk, which was something that a lot of reviewers were talking about, he said that that was, like, a complete misunderstanding of the song. He said, quote, the lyrics are about banality, about the abuse of words, and the lyrics themselves have an internal logic, which is super interesting. And in a Rolling Stone interview in February of 1988, he says, I was trying to make an intellectual point about how the simple can be so powerful. In the song, I tried to address that issue, but everyone said, this is just child's play. No one actually listened to the lyrics. He later said, I was trying to say something which was really quite difficult, that people like politicians, like myself even, use words to manipulate people and that you should be very careful. This is so interesting, because I think that song, when I heard it before looking into it, I always just assumed that he was making fun of those songs and that, you know, he was making fun of songs that are kind of nonsense and don't mean anything. And he is, kind of. But through these interviews, I think what he's really saying is that if you're not paying attention, this song is going to slip through the cracks, because it really is about, you know, listening to the things around you. It reminds me of Chained to the Rhythm by Katy Perry, about, you know, always watch and always listen to what type of art you are consuming, because it can mean anything. And I think that's super cool for a song like this that you wouldn't really look twice at, because like I said, it is extremely catchy and very radio friendly, and they play it all the time, and I think it's super easy for it to just, you know, kind of be glazed over a little bit. But the phrase itself, da do da do da 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 da, which is the very long annoying title to type out in my notes, was apparently made up by Sting's son. Sting said that, in fact, my son came up with it. I've never paid him, so that's another possible lawsuit. He writes songs himself these days. He's got a lot of self-confidence. I don't know where from. Very Sting quote. But I think that's really funny that it actually is baby talk. I think that's hilarious. But going back to what you said about, you know, my job and, you know, politician's job is to manipulate words. It's one of the lyrics in the stanzas of this song says, poets, priests, and politicians have words to thank for their positions. Words that scream for your submission, and no one's jamming their transmission. So that's kind of him further detailing that point of, you know, be observant, be on the watch. And really all of these huge, you know, figureheads behind jobs like that, priests, politicians, poets like himself, you know, songwriters, entertainers, they're all manipulating words for better or for worse to cater to certain audiences. And then we go straight into the chorus. Da do da do da 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 is all I want to say to you. Their innocence will pull me through. They're meaningless, and all that's true. So I think that this is just a super cool song. Lyrically, it sounds great. It's definitely a high point of their career, and we just had to include it because we're talking about The Police. I mean, come on. And this is the only song that I'm going to play you guys that's not on Synchronicity. So soak in some early years Police before we really nail in 1983. I hope you enjoy this song. This is Da Do Da Do Da 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 Da.
Yeah.
maybe that type of talent just runs in the family, but imagine being Sting's son and knowing that you are to thank for one of the most recognizable hits of the 80s. I mean, I feel like that's got to be a big chip on your shoulder from that young of an age, but y'all, that song just never gets old. I knew I had to play it. But we're moving on to a very deeper cut than everything that we've played before. I'll be surprised if any casual listeners have heard this one before, which is why I chose it, because it's very weird, very Sting, very Synchronicity era Police, and I'm super excited. This song is called Tea in the Sahara, and I remember just being blown away by this song when I heard it for the first time. When I listened to Synchronicity for the first time all the way through, this one was my favorite. And I just remember being very, very interested in what it all meant. And I will be honest, until now, I never knew the true meaning. In my head, I had always just made it up. And I had my own story to go along with it, which I think is kind of the point, and that's what you're supposed to do. But for the sake of this episode, I've dug deep into the WikiHow trenches to find a lot of old interviews from Sting explaining this. And so I have a very long quote from the man himself talking about the song, so get ready. But Tea in the Sahara was written solely by Sting, and it appeared on Synchronicity, of course, in 1983. And the lyrics were inspired by the Paul Bowles book, The Sheltering Sky, who Sting was a really huge fan of. And the lyrics are based off of that story. So here's the super long quote, buckle in. Paul Bowles had written very many books, but he wrote a book called The Sheltering Sky, which became a film by Bertolucci a few years ago. I read it long before it was a film, and it's one of the most beautiful, sustained, and poetic novels I've ever read. It's about Americans that regard themselves as travelers, not tourists, and I class myself in that category. He's so down to earth. I'm a hopeless tourist, but I'm constantly on the move. There was a story within that story that was a sort of Arab legend that was told in the story of three sisters who invite a prince to a tea party out of the desert to have tea, tea in the Sahara. They have tea and it's wonderful, and he promises to come back but never does. They just wait and wait and wait until it's far too late. I just love this story, and I wrote a song called Tea in the Sahara. I don't know whether Paul Bowles has ever heard it. Probably not, but it's still one of my favorite songs. Woo! Wow. So that's the full, just out there explanation. It's funny to see which artists will explain their songs away and which ones won't. Sting is kind of known for, he'll just give an interview and say whatever. But, you know, I think even now in the modern day, I think a lot of artists kind of shy away from that, because I do think that information can kind of hurt a little bit sometimes, because this song is not something that I expected to be so literal. I mean, this song is literally word for word just that story translated into song form, which is a completely valid form of art, and it's beautiful and great in its own right. But in my head, it was a much bigger, grander, you know, kind of dream sequence that Sting had thought up. And, you know, to me, it still is that. But upon knowing this information, I think I do look at the song differently and less imaginatively. And I think sometimes knowing the exact meaning of something can kind of hurt a little bit. So that's just an interesting thing and opinion I wanted to throw into this episode. But now that we know, the reviews for Tea in the Sahara were relatively good. It probably is one of the deepest cuts off of the album. But in his review for Rolling Stone, critiquer Stephen Holden said that Tea in the Sahara is Synchronicity's moodiest, most tantalizing song, and said it was an oral mirage that brings back the bird calls and jungle sounds of earlier songs as whispering, ghostly instrumental voices. Which is a super great quote, because the beginning tracks of this song, like Walking In, or this song, the beginning tracks of this album, Synchronicity, songs like Walking In Your Footsteps and stuff like that, they are a little bit more like jungly. They have like some weird like drum things going on there. Like they have bongos and maracas, and that's just part of the Police's, you know, catch all with, you know, expanding into different types of music that you wouldn't expect them to. And that's why they're so interesting as a band. But Tea in the Sahara, it kind of abandons that and strips away a lot of the flashier, more like interesting elements of the rest of the production of the album. And I think it kind of leaves you with, he said it perfectly, a kind of ghostly feeling. And it is kind of eerie. And I think that that's kind of the magic of it. It is very empty, which is the feeling of the story that you're supposed to be getting. Stephen Thomas Erdwine of AllMusic said that the song is hypnotic in its measured melancholy choruses, and it is a fable ultimately about a broken promise. So I think that thematically, even though it is just an allegory, I think it also pairs well with the rest of the song's themes, which a lot of them are about Sting's divorce that had happened recently before this album came out. And I think that type of broken promise and, you know, kind of being led astray reminds me of earlier tracks like Wrapped Around Your Finger or even King of Pain, of those feelings of lingering loss and yearning, which just makes for great music fodder. So thank God for things like that. But my favorite line in the song is, "Please don't ask us why, beneath the sheltering sky." I've always loved that line because I think sheltering sky is such an interesting thing. And little did I know, guys, that's perfect because the book is called The Sheltering Sky. So I had some sort of intuition going on there. But I'm excited to play you guys this song. It's one of my favorite from The Police. And now that I know the meaning, it has just definitely evolved in my mind. So I'm interested to hear what you guys think. And maybe if you hadn't heard what it was about beforehand, what you would think that it was about, because it is a little weird to decipher. But here is Sting's take on The Sheltering Sky. Let me know what you think.
If our minds are deranged, please don't ask us why. Beneath the sheltering sky, we have this strange obsession. You have the means in your possession. Seeing the star with you. Seeing the star with you. Man agreed he would satisfy their need, so they danced for his pleasure with a joy you could not measure. They wait for him, dear, the same place every year, beneath the sheltering sky. Across the desert he would fly, in the Sahara. With you, tea in the Sahara. With you, tea in the Sahara. With you, tea in the Sahara. With you.
the moment that I started airing that song, my cat like slithered in through the crack of my door. I think it like summoned him somehow. But oh, I love that song. It's so weird. I love it. But now that we've moved on from all of the songs before the penultimate final track that I'm going to play you, I am ready to introduce this song. Of course, you already know it's got to be Every Breath You Take. Guys, I'm going to be honest. Some of these bands or these artists that I play, I kind of won't play like the elephant in the room. Like we did the Halloween episode, I didn't play Thriller on purpose. We do like Green Day, I didn't play American Idiot on purpose because I just feel like it's like low-hanging fruit and we kind of expect it too much. But Every Breath You Take is such an important song, and it's one of those huge, like humongous hits that I still never get tired of, and I just have to play it. I feel like I do. And the meaning of it is very interesting because people kind of split it between two paths based on what they think it means. And I just think it's a super interesting track to discuss because it is one of the most influential radio hits of all time. So obviously on this lovely radio we've been blessed with, I must discuss it. It's just my duty. But Every Breath You Take really needs no introduction, but by God, have I researched one. And guys, just strap in. I'm going to try not to get out of breath. Try not to zone out on me. These are the stats for Every Breath You Take. I feel like you could probably guess that it was written by Sting and came out on Synchronicity in 1983, which it did, so we're off to a good start. But it was the biggest American-Canadian hit of 1983, which is saying a lot of good music from that year. And it topped the Billboard Hot 100 Singles chart for 8 weeks, which is the band's only number one hit on that chart, and the Canadian RPM chart for 2 weeks. It was their fifth UK number one, and it topped the UK singles chart for 4 weeks. It also reached the top 10 in other countries, lots of them are in Europe. In May 2019, it was recognized by BMI as the most played song in radio history with over 15 million plays. 15 million plays. That is so incredibly difficult to even like wrap your head around or wrap your finger around if we're on the theme of Synchronicity. But that is just, oh, that's crazy numbers. And to further illustrate that point, as of 2003, Sting was expected to be making an average of $2,000 a day in royalties just for Every Breath You Take, which is crazy. So I guess, you know, just pump one of these out in your career and you're pretty much set for life. So just do that really quick. In 2010, it was estimated to generate between a quarter and a third of Sting's music publishing income, which is wild, especially because he's had such a successful career both in and out of the Police. Like, I don't think he really needs this to boost him anymore. And at the 26th annual Grammy Awards, it was nominated for 3, Song of the Year, Best Pop Performance, and Record of the Year, winning in the first 2 categories. For the song, Sting received the 1983 Ivor Novello Award for Best Song Musically and Lyrically from the British Academy of Songwriters, Composers, and Authors. In 2004, it was ranked number 84 on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs of All Time list. Haven't heard about that list in a while. It's coming back. Although it was moved down to number 305 in their 2021 update, which is quite a big drop. I think that's interesting, but the song is included in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because, of course, and it's also ranked number 25 on Billboard's Hot 100 All-Time Top Songs, which is crazy. Y'all should just see that lineup. That is an insane, like, masterful, grand champion lineup, so it's important that it's on there. In the 1983 Rolling Stone Critics and Readers poll, it was voted Song of the Year. In the US, it was a best-selling single of 1983 and the fifth best-selling single of the decade, which is crazy. And Billboard ranked it as number one for 1983, just the number one song of that year. And possibly my favorite award that it's been given. In 2015, it was voted by the British public as the nation's favorite 1980s number one in a UK-wide poll, which is crazy. That's their favorite 80s number one. And we had our second British invasion around that time, y'all, so they had some good stuff to pick from. I just love fan votes like that. I really do think it means more than any, you know, weird like cabinet or, you know, official meeting of any conglomerate. I think that, you know, the people who are buying the music and listening on the radio, their opinions are the ones that matter. So I think that's super interesting. So now that we've gotten all the stats out of the way, I think we all know what a huge, like beefy song this really is. We're going to talk a little bit about the creation of it and the meaning behind it. So to kind of try and escape the public eye, Sting was retreating to the Caribbean, originally intending for Synchronicity to be more of a reggae record than it was, and he started writing Every Breath You Take at Ian Fleming's writing desk in Orcabessa, Jamaica, and the lyrics are the words of a possessive lover who is watching every breath you take and every move you make. Sting said in a Rolling Stone interview, I woke up in the middle of the night with that line in my head, sat down at the piano, and had written it in half an hour. The tune itself is generic, an aggregate of hundreds of others, but the words are interesting. It sounds like a comforting love song. I didn't realize at the time how sinister it really is. I was thinking of Big Brother, Surveillance and Control. In a BBC Radio 2 interview, he said, "I think the song is very sinister and ugly, and people have actually misinterpreted it as being a gentle little love song when it's quite the opposite." So that is super interesting. I feel like maybe at the time people didn't realize, but I do think everybody accepts how creepy this song is now. But I never picked up on the whole Big Brother thing in the way that he's talking about maybe a greater, stronger spirit than just another person. And one of my favorite quotes about this song is from Gary T. Marks. He's a sociologist and a scholar of surveillance studies. And in 1988, he published a paper on this song. And he said that it was a love song rather than a protest song, and that it nicely captures elements of new surveillance. He said that every breath you take could be linked to breath analyzers, every step you take to ankle monitors, and every vowel you break to voice stress analysis, which is so interesting because in the late 80s, we kind of had this new reformation of forensic technology, especially in like publicized trials and televised trials. And we're starting to get all of this new like surveillance tech that's being used for good. But I think that anxiety still surrounds it, you know, because that can be used for anybody. And this feeling of constantly being watched has definitely gotten even worse with, you know, social media and cell phones and stuff like that. And I think that's a really interesting point, because I had never thought about the greater historical and pop culture implications of this song, but it makes sense. And harkening back to when Sting was talking about how generic this tune is, I mean, I think that we can all agree that that opening guitar and the just everything that's going on behind Sting's vocals are part of the really attractive pull of this song. And according to Phil Spector himself in the Back to Mono box set book, this song is influenced by a Gene Pitney song titled Every Breath I Take, the Hassles' 1967 song Every Step I Take, co-written by Billy Joel, and Led Zeppelin's song Dire Maker. It also contains the words Every Breath I Take, Every Move I Make. Those songs both kind of have the same thing going on. So that is super interesting. And, you know, I've said this 100 times throughout the course of this podcast and every episode that we've done, that art is just constantly evolving onto itself. And sometimes when those layers get stacked up, you have things that link together unexpectedly. We saw that. I'm going to bring up the Nirvana episode again. We saw that there. We saw that in the Bob Dylan Steely Dan episode. You know, you see it a lot throughout history because things just line up that way. And I think I love it, honestly, when huge hits like this have very clear, drawable influences, because I think it shows how important starting points for music is. I mean, you had everything from the 50s all the way to the late 70s influencing this song, because that's what it takes to make a mega hit like this. Producer Hugh Padgham claimed that by the time they were recording and doing the sessions for this song, Sting and Stuart Copeland hated each other, that's a quote from him, with verbal and physical fights occurring in the studio commons, and the tensions almost led to them just canceling the recording sessions until they had a meeting with the band and the group's manager, Miles Copeland, who was Stuart Copeland's brother, fun fact, and they resulted in an agreement to continue. And during the recording of this song, the room was reportedly so hot that Copeland's drumsticks had to be taped to his hands so they wouldn't slip out because his palms were so sweaty. So no wonder they're so mad at each other. It sounds like it was 100 degrees in there, but you could never tell because his drumming is amazing. There were 2 cover versions of this on the Hot Country Singles chart in 1983 at the same time, which is so interesting. Rich Landers at number 68 and Mason Dixon, shout out, at number 69. So right there with each other. I think that's so interesting. This song is also notably sampled in Puff Daddy's 1997 hit I'll Be Missing You, which is at the top of the Billboard Hot 100 for 11 weeks and won a Grammy Award for Best Rap Performance by a Duo or Group. Sting ultimately participated in a performance of it at the 1997 MTV Video Music Awards, which I love. I love when artists support each other and cross genres like that. That reminds me of when Stevie Wonder performed with Coolio on Gangster's Paradise. I think that's great when people can span genres like that. And I'll Be Missing You is a great marker of its time as well. So according to Stuart Copeland in a 2000 interview, he said, "In my humble opinion, this is Sting's best song with the worst arrangement. I think Sting could have had any other group do this song and it would have been better than our version, except for Andy's brilliant guitar part." Basically, there's an utter lack of groove. It's a totally wasted opportunity for our band. Even though we made gazillions off of it, it's the biggest hit we ever had. When I listen to this recording, I think, God, what a bunch of idiots we were. And I'm gonna leave you guys with that quote. I mean, who would think a song that has 15 million radio plays, and that was as of last year, so probably even more now, that the person who helped co-write it could say, God, we were idiots. Like, someone else should have done it. I think that's so interesting. And I love facts and stories behind songs like that, where you would never know. You would never know that Stuart Copeland's drumsticks were about to slip out of his hands. And you would certainly never know that it has an apparently awful arrangement. I mean, I would never pick up on that. But I'll let you guys decide for yourself. I'm sure that you've all heard this song before, and I'm just adding to the 15 million radio plays. So let's put another $2,000 in Sting's pocket. Here is one of the best songs of the decade, and the best song of the 80s, according to the British public, Every Breath You Take.
Step you take, I'll be watching you.
I mean, that has just got to be one of the most instantly recognizable songs of all time. I feel like you just need, like, three notes from that at the opening, and anyone could tell you what's playing, which is the marker of a very important and integral part of music history. And that's what this show is all about. But I really enjoyed talking about, briefly, an overview of the Police. We might come back and revisit them later because I do love their music and they have some really interesting stories nestled in there along the way. So let me know if you want to hear more about them. But thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Let me know what you liked, what you'd like to hear next. And as always, my name's Caroline. This has been Put It In Your Pocket. Thank you for listening.